This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So let's start with US 77 and maybe starting with the photographic component. How did you make these images?
I lived in New York on a US-UK bicentennial arts exchange fellowship in the mid-70s, and at one point, as every European inevitably does, set out for a cross-US trip, a road trip. And the photographs came from that period, from that trip, and also from New York.
And then, of course, these photographs are overlain with text, and there's a very interesting method of production that you used that involves rephotographing. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Not rephotographing as such. That was a very different period. You know, 1976, when I would actually have been taking these pictures, was a time when one didn't hear much about photography in the art world. I think there was one photo gallery in New York, if you can believe that. And I used to go to this one bookstore where, from time to time, they would have a new photo book on the shelf, and that was a great event when that happened. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine now. So I had this interest in photography, but wasn't able to feed it very well in that period. So in that period, I wasn't interested in photography as such. For all I was trying to inform myself about photography as I'd picked up the camera. But the reason I picked up the camera was not because I was a photo, freak. It was rather because of my interest. Okay, I mean, to put it very simply, I was trained as a painter at the Royal College of Art. You know, I have a first-class diploma in painting. As I like to say, I'm legally entitled to practice painting anywhere in the United Kingdom. Anywhere I care to hang out my shingle, I can paint. But then I went to Yale and got into minimalism and eventually became one of that generation who were then named as conceptualists. And it was all very well, except it got to a point when I felt split between my concerns in my professional life and my concerns in my personal life. Again, we were talking about this the other day, and in the seminars, as you say, there will be some repetition for those who were there, for which I apologize, but I remember at Yale in the painting school, around about 65, Frank Stella came up, and Michael Fried was writing about Frank Stella at that time, and in one of his articles, probably in Art Forum, he said that Stella has an advanced attitude to the framing edge. And I remember sitting around with these guys going through six-pack after six-pack, earnestly discussing whether our attitude to the framing edge was sufficiently advanced. And there were discussions, Frankenthaler came up, and Frankenthaler used to soak her paint from the back of the canvas, the cotton dock, rather than put it in from the front. And we endlessly discussed the ramifications of that. So it's a very narrow world that I was living in. And, you leave school, and then there you are, the landlord wants the rent, your girlfriend's threatening to dump you, and he said, yeah, but what about the framing edge? And I mean, what about the important questions? So I became unhappy with all of that, and I wanted a practice that would allow me to make a relationship between what I was doing in my studio and what I was doing outside the studio. So the camera, I turned to the camera, as I say, not because I was particularly interested in the aesthetics of photography, but rather because the photographic image was the image, and again, in the mid-70s, you would say it was the image through which dominant systems of beliefs and values were perpetuated in newspapers, in glossy journals, in other kinds of magazines, on billboards. You couldn't go through a day in the so-called advanced world when you didn't see an image, and now it's even more the case with mobile devices. So that kind of imagery, photographic imagery, seemed to me to be a way in which I could connect with the outside world. But I didn't want to set out to be a documentary photographer. I thought, you know, there are already plenty of people doing that. And moreover, if I say I'm interested in the image in its relation to the social world, if I say I'm interested in the photograph in its relation to the social world, then what I mean by the image necessarily is different from what most people would have meant by the image in that period. Because the photograph was never encountered without text, ever. You always see, it's still the case, you always see photography in relationship to text. So even the most ardently separatist, aestheticist, formalist photographer who might say, oh, my work is purely visual, they have a caption to their work when they exhibit it in a gallery. There's a title to the show. The artist's name appears prominently. They hope to get reviews. There's a handout for the press. They have discussions. You know, they're bathed in language, and arguably, it wouldn't be art unless they were bathed in language. And we saw this in the history of photography, of course, that photographs of Walker Evans, for example, that were made exclusively for journals, that were accompanied by text, often Evans wrote his own texts in journals, now they're taken out, they're framed beautifully, they hung on the gallery wall. They were never intended to be shown in that way, but now they're art, but they've become art because now they've been christened in the bath and the font of artistic discourse. So, you know, it's a kind of gesture that Duchamp made. It's analogous to that in bringing the urinal into the gallery, into the museum, and the urinal becomes art. Photography, in being brought into the discursive formation of the art world, became art. That's the way these things work. That's how it works. So the image for me is that which floats between the textual image and the optical image. Because the image, when people say purely visual, they're talking about the optical, but the image is never purely optical. If the image were purely optical, you would be seeing the world upside down, because that's the image on the back of your retina. But the brain corrects it. And the brain doesn't only correct that image, it also adds to it. It brings memories, associations, fantasies, and so on. So the image for me, as I notice for both Kaja and Homé, is always virtual. When you read, if you read a novel, for example, you form images. And when you look at photographs, you form words pass through your head, you know, involuntarily, words pass through your head.
The issue you raised just now took me off course, or I'm going to veer off course for a moment. But first, I just want to say that it was Clement Greenberg who always used that advanced word. It's like advanced in relation to what? It sounds almost like evolution, the theory of evolution. It's extremely bizarre. So what I wanted to bring up, and then I want to come back to this series, is this idea that I think you regard images and words as in between. That they go between, in a certain sense. They pass between people. I mean, of course, we all would say that words pass between us, but they pass between us in order to be completed psychically within an interior space. Does that sound right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that would be a step in the direction of addressing the very unusual form that psychoanalysis takes in your work, or how the Enlightenment and psychoanalysis could be embraced together. Do you want to?
Sure, yes, because what I might have gone on to say as a way of getting into an answer to your intervention is that at that time, in the 70s, I adopted the 35 millimeter photo documentary genre or practice of photography. But at that time, as I say, there were very few photo galleries, and the ones that showed that kind of photography would show those images framed and very small, because the, you know, the photographic aesthetics of the period favored fine-grained film and fine detail. So to blow up the image, the 35mm image, so you can see the grain and make it large, is already to take it out of that sphere. To put text over it is to bring it closer to the sphere of journals,
yeah.
Magazine journals.
So that was actually the precise thing that I had planned to address, which is how different this is from Dan Graham's Homes in America. The scale is very astonishing. The blowing up of the grain is not a de-skilling or an anti-aesthetic gesture. I think it realizes the images, or it takes them somehow into the domain of the aesthetic.
It also emphasizes the point that the text is formed in the same substrate as the image, that just as the image is a constellation of grains, so the text is a constellation of grains, but just in a different constellation. So it's as if you have this granular substance, the substrate, the silver salts, which take form slightly differently, but they're essentially the same. And that's the kind of thing that I wanted to emphasize.
Yeah. And that's what I asked you about when I said refotographing, which was incorrect, but that's what I was getting at too,
yes.
The idea that the text will have the same grain as the photograph, as the image. The text is image, it becomes part of it. And then this other gesture that you mentioned of adopting the rhetoric and conventions of, say, magazine advertising or pseudo-advertising, and normally the text would be describing the product and creating desire for it, and here you've detoured that in a way. You've used the text in a totally different way, and it actually operates slightly differently in each panel. And I think today it's actually kind of commonplace to see fine photography adopt advertising rhetoric to install in light boxes, for example.
Yes.
But at this time, that was not the case.
Well, the scale by itself is just kind of astonishing. And then the text is very slippery. It's full of equivocations and puns, and so there is, it also is, doesn't have the kind of, it's not the throwaway language, it's not the kind of flattened out or zero affect language of much conceptual art.
And you mentioned psychoanalysis, and I was getting around to that. My interest in photography was in photography in as much as it contributed to ideology, to beliefs and values, you know, the values according to which people act in all good faith, honestly, but often on the basis of erroneous ideas. So I was interested in that aspect of it. And advertising was the most obvious place to go if you were interested in that. And advertising, of course, very openly and self-consciously plays with image and text. And in fact, more so back then, arguably, or at least in a different way than it does now. So I was interested in the rhetoric of those text-image relationships, and I was playing with those in this work. And I was also teaching that. That's what I became interested in teaching. So I became interested in semiotics. Of course, Kaja's first book, The Subject of Semiotics, was a very important early contribution to the efflorescence of semiotic theory in that period. And I was, as I say, I was teaching text-image relationships, and I was also working through them differently in my own practice in the art world. Now, semiotics at the onset back then was based in Saussurean linguistics, and it's the most extraordinarily effective analytical tool in relation to advertising, for sure. up to a certain point, because although it can account in a very nuanced and very accurate way, of course, it's not concerned with what images mean or with what advertising means. You know, it wasn't the object of my teaching to explain what the photograph meant or what the advertisement meant. I mean, it's obvious. People know. But how? It's not what does it mean, it's how does it mean? How does it work as a mechanism? You see the mechanism, you see the meaning, but then the theory intervenes to make that strange, to defamiliarize it, as Shklovsky would have said. And it puts this kind of measuring grid between you and the ad, and then you can see how the wheels are turning to create that sense of immediacy. So I was interested in that, and as I say, it's a very effective tool in deconstructing or analyzing the social meanings of the image. But it's not very good. In fact, it was, you know, pretty awful. It's totally inadequate, almost, at analyzing the emotional effect of images. And this became, for me, an increasingly a problem. Not for me working as an artist, but for me teaching. Because I thought, if I can't explain to my students the emotion that they can feel in relation to a photograph, then my teaching is lacking, it's inadequate. One question, for example, is how is it that in looking at one photograph your mind will be taken elsewhere? It might be taken to another photograph, or it might just be taken to a memory or a fantasy. How does that happen? Or how is it that a photograph that one person will find completely banal, you are moved by in a way that you can't really account for? So in looking around for an adequate account of that kind of affective relation to the image, then I turned, as a number of people in that period did, to psychoanalysis. And that's why I brought in psychoanalysis, as a way of adding to the account of the production of meaning.
But it has survived as an important thing in your life. I mean, it survived that historical moment. It has gone on to serve, to do other things in your thought, I would think. Maybe we can, yeah.
Yeah, well, as a way of thinking, the insights offered by, I feel the same about Marxism. I mean, I don't teach or even read particularly Marxist literature anymore, but there are certain insights that once you've had them, but they never let you go, and it's the same with psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis permeates my view of the world.
That's what I was saying. Mm. Homemade?
Well, should we move on to The Little House?
I think we should do that.
Okay. And we will return to some of these questions of image and text, surely, throughout the conversation. So The Little House, which is in the rear gallery here, was made in 2005. It features a domestic architecture by Rudolf Schindler, the King's Road House in Los Angeles. Could you tell us a little bit about how that commission came about and the materials for it, and also how it was installed when you installed it there?
Most of my work's done in response to invitations to go somewhere and make a work in response to a place. In this case, this was something of an exception, because I'd back in 76, while I was living in New York, I'd started to exhibit at a gallery called John Weber Gallery, a very important gallerist, as the French call them, because, you know, dealer sounds too reduced a term, because it's not just about, at least it wasn't just about money in those days. I mean, John really had an interest in the art, and he knew what he was showing, and there's stuff he wouldn't show, even though he knew he could make money from it. You know, they were different people back then. You still find them, but, art's become such a big business. And I've been showing with John from 76, and then, I forget precisely, early 2000s, I guess. He went bankrupt. Big surprise after what I've just said. Anyway, he went bankrupt, and I was without a gallery. And then I was in Paris opening another show in the Paris Gallery, which subsequently went bankrupt. I think galleries have learned to stay away from me. But I was introduced to a woman whose name was Bergen, same name as me, Christine Bergen. She said that she had a gallery in New York, and she knew John had folded, and she invited me to show with her. And we got on well. And she said, there's a book that I'd really like you to read. And she sent me this book, The Little House, which was the recently published English translation with a preface by Anthony Vidler, who I know has been to Slott, of the of an 18th century libertine novella by, I think, Jean-François Bastide. It's Bastide, I think it was Jean-François. La Petite Maison. And obviously I speculated on why she thought I would be interested in libertine novellas, but I did find it very interesting. And as a kind of reciprocal gesture, this rather grandiose idea came to mind. I thought of Jung sending Freud a copy of Jensen's Gradiva, a Pompeian fantasy, as a kind of gesture of appreciation. But as a gesture of appreciation back to Christine Bergen, I thought, well, I'll make a work. And my first show at Christine Bergen, it's a very small gallery.
But tell me about the book.
Yeah, I shall.
The book is unbelievable.
Yeah, okay. So, the book. Back in the 18th century, in 18th century France, there was really no distinction at all between the role of the architect and the role of the interior decorator. It was the same. It was the same job. And not uncommonly, architects would hire hack writers to produce what was, you know, essentially publicity. And some architect, we don't know who exactly, hired Bastide, who was a hack writer of the time, but very competent one, to write this story, this novella, with the hope that as this was read, distributed and read throughout, this was just pre-revolutionary France, we're still with the Ancien Régime, but quite advanced in the 18th century nevertheless, the clientele, the wealthy clientele who read it would be moved to hire the architect. So the story is, structurally, it's the irresistible force meets the immovable object. The irresistible force is the Marquis de Trémicourt, who is impossibly handsome, unbelievably rich, charming, cultured, you know, he has it all. Women fall at his feet just at the mention of his name, but he's only interested in Mélite. Mélite is brilliant, cultured, all the rest, and totally virtuous. And there's no way that she's going to accede to his demands. And they talk about it. You know, we're in 18th century France. We're in the salon. Women are very much a part of the conversation. They speak openly about Trémicourt's desire for Mélite, and she tells him to forget it. And he says, well, okay, I'll issue a challenge. Visit me in my petite maison, and we'll see what happens. Okay, now what is a petite maison? Well, for a start, it's not petite, it's big. In that period, characteristically, if you were as filthy rich as the Marquis de Trémicourt, you would have your chateau on your lands in the countryside, which of course was the basis of your wealth. Then you would have your hotel in the city, which was again a small private palace, where you would do your deals, you would entertain clients and dignitaries and so on. You might very well have a maison de plaisance, usually on the outskirts of Paris, so you could look towards the city in one direction, but towards the country in the other. And that's where you'd have your fête champêtre, these big parties with people strumming Baroque guitars, like in the Watteau paintings. But in addition to these properties, you would, because these people were never alone, ever alone. So if you wanted to be alone for some special deal with some foreign politician or some very wealthy merchant, But more usually, if you wanted to have an affair, then you would do that in your petite maison, your little house. And they're called petite maison. It's a long series of puns that I won't go into because I don't remember them. But they involve notions of insanity. So insane things would happen in the petite maison. So the Marquis de Trémicourt challenges Mélite to visit his petite maison. Then they will see what happens. And Mélite says, I accept your challenge. I need fear you there nor anywhere else. So she goes to the petite maison. And so the book is then a tour. He takes her on a tour of the house. He takes her to this room. And of course, every time they visit a room, the room is described in great detail. The paints, the decorations, the vases. And then as they progress through the house, Elite starts to be a little swayed, as Trémicourt says to her. He says, well, you know, you have to admit that you can't think of me as being such an insensitive person if I have a taste like this. And
so, sentence. I don't know if you put that in her mouth, where she says, perhaps her previous life had not been so much about strength as about the insufficiency of the challenge.
That's right. She says, if in the past, she doesn't say that to him. She thinks to herself. She suddenly becomes anxious, and she reflects to herself that if in the past she'd been so successful at resisting her desires, it was perhaps not because her resistance was strong, but because her desires had been weak. So it goes on, and her resistance starts to flag under the impact of the interior design and the interior decor, until in the end, in the last chapter, she goes into this final room, and she says, "Oh, this is just too much," and she swoons onto the nearest couch, and Trémicourt has his evil way. End of story. And of course, the client reading this will think, just what I need is a petite maison like that, a kind of seduction machine. And that's the story, and that's what I staged.
So the red book, we didn't really talk about that yesterday.
Well, we should also say that although the 18th century, in France at least, was a relatively progressive period, in terms of the emancipation of women and the place of women in the conversation in cultural circles, it has to be said that this book ended in an unambiguous triumph for the man. So, and also he had a lot of the best lines too. So what I did is I spiced up Mélite's repartee. I took words from La Rochefoucauld and I gave them to Mélite, so she has some cutting rejoinders throughout the conversation they're having. And then at the end, when he takes her into the boudoir, I put the boudoir with French windows which are open onto the garden, and I start the story in the garden. So they get to the boudoir, and just as he's about to make his final move, she gets up and she goes out into the garden. And of course the video loops, and so it all starts again. And Trémicourt is in perpetual pursuit of this unattainable object of desire. And that's the structure of it.
So it's a vertigo-like story, which has been another point of reference for you. I just had a thought that, I don't know why this, I'm thinking this for the first time, but the libertine novella is a form of advertisement. It's an advertisement for the architect's services. These are also images based on advertising. The house itself is a kind of, it's designed to create desire or seduce or persuade. And then even the little red book, to get to that, could in a slightly perverse way be thought of as a persuasive or advertisement for communism.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
But you mentioned also the loop form, and that was something we wanted to talk more about. So the little house is both a looped projection, and you utilize a formal technique, a kind of panoramic scrolling shot.
Yes.
Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, this was before I started using computer software to make my imagery. And at that time, I was using a camera, a 35mm digital SLR. And it was mounted on a panoramic head. It's a technique, actually, that everyone's very familiar with. So if you just think of what the use that realtors make of these panoramic images on the internet now, it's that kind of thing. Or automobile manufacturers will show the interior of a vehicle using these things. So it involves mounting a camera on a panoramic head, taking a number of shots from the same position in a circle, and then stitching them together in software, and then animating them in software, so you get that scrolling. And for me, that was I adopted that because I didn't want to be a photographer. I just wanted to show the space in the most economical and comprehensive way. I didn't want to have to be, you know, going down on one knee or hanging from a rafter or, you know, doing any of those things that imply an embodied point of view. And the good thing about this technique for me is that in order for the photographs to be stitched together in the computer, certain conditions have to be met, certain technical conditions. So the camera has to be perfectly horizontal, and there can be no parallax. And the only way there's no parallax is if the nodal point of the lens is directly over the axis of rotation. That's a kind of technical notion. But what it really means is that the camera is revolving around a mathematical point of zero dimensions. And of course, the body can't do that. So it's a literally disembodied point of view. It's a ghost's point of view.
Yeah, so I continue to be baffled about that particular aspect of your work. I mean, I'm eager to find out, to make sense of it, the impersonal optic. I think Andre started talking about the beautiful impersonality yesterday after the in our Q&A period. So I'm wanting to make sense of it in relation to your interest in psychoanalysis, because most people who are interested in psychoanalysis would be motivating, would be thinking of anchoring the camera somehow to the subjectivity of a character. And I feel like there is subjectivity in your work, but it is not where one is used to finding it. Even that becomes a kind of signature gesture. So it becomes claimed by you in a certain kind of way. But that was why I said, that was why I remarked upon the notion that an image is completed inside, because in a way it's thinking about interiority or subjectivity, not as the property, so to speak, of an individual, but it's like an image moving in and out of various interiorities and being completed in slightly different ways. So it's like a collective subjectivity. Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Exactly. So have a moment of confession time. I've always been a bit embarrassed by being an artist. You know, the idea of the artist occupying that position. It's kind of an embarrassing position to be in, because it's such a schlocky kind of image. And nevertheless, it's an image that, you know, a great deal of artists clearly enjoy enormously, all this kind of, you know, me, and as if everything comes from them. And of course, if there's one thing that psychoanalysis teaches you, if you learn anything from it, is that actually very little comes from you. A lot goes through you, and is inflected through your experience. But then your experience is accidentally happened to you. There's a lot that happens to you that you don't really initiate it and inaugurate it. Yeah. And of course, that turn to an interest in advertising photography and advertisements and analyzing advertisements was, again, another way of trying to make art that doesn't say, oh, I'm an artist, you listen to me, you know, I'm really sensitive and you guys are kind of stupid, but you can learn from me, right? And that was really embarrassing. And I would say, look, you know, look, folks, I'm talking about things that you know about. And I don't really know any more than you know, but we're all in this together. It just happens to be my professional task to try to deal with that and to represent it and to put it up in a way that I hope you will engage with. So it's, you know, kind of more, for lack of a better word, demotic or yeah. democratic, or it's that kind of a. It was a kind of trying to back away from the subject position as it's given to us of the artist, the way it's presented in, you know. Yeah. So we know what that image is.
What I really like about this is instead of an argument like the unconscious is structured like a language, which in some weird kind of way universalizes, it depersonalizes the psyche, but it also standardizes it in a strange kind of way. Your notion that an image is completed within this psyche and then that psyche allows for that image to be different in each case. So there's a shared, it's like an image that is partially shared and partially not. So that there's a kind of enigmatic dimension to the image that we're looking at now as seen by you, either one of you, because I know that I'm sharing part of it, but I don't know how it's completed.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the work is incomplete without the contribution of the viewer. So I make work that is incomplete, that leaves spaces for the person who's working with it to complete it in their own way. Yeah.
There's something about the panoramic tripod setup that it's impersonal, and it makes it so that we can't attach to a body and a particular eye, which to me, that's a non-egoic form of looking or subjectivity. Yeah. And so maybe that leaves room for other versions of it to come into play or to situate it somewhere else.
But it also has the potential to turn into an institutional optic or... yeah, I think there's some paranoid possibilities there.
Yeah. Well, and that, yeah, the computer-generated point of view has a, there's something similar we could talk about with that. Yeah. If we want to move on to...
And I think that you probably are, in a sense, working through that idea in Prairie. Yeah, I think that you are.
And so A Place to Read was the first, if I'm getting this right, projection that you made that involved wholly computer-generated...
Yes.
3D imagery. Could you tell us about the invitation in Istanbul and how that work came about and also how you installed it there? I remember reading about that and it was quite different from what we've got here.
It was an invitation on the occasion of Istanbul 2010 Cultural Capital of Europe. So, you know, they get European money, European Union money to stage a cultural festival, and part of that involves inviting artists to go there and work there. And so part of that year's festival was something they called Lives and Works in Istanbul, and they invited some artists who actually lived and worked in Istanbul, and then they invited some other artists to go there and live and work there. So I went there on a number of occasions for more or less long periods of time, and eventually produced that work. And that's when I started using computer modeling, because as I said, I was had a history of being invited to places and make a work in response to the place. In the case of the Little House, again, a response to a building, and I photographed the building. Whereas in this case, I couldn't photograph the building because it no longer existed. It had been torn down. Mutilated, re-erected in a different place, turned into something else. You couldn't photograph it, not in its previous form. It was a coffee house. So that kind of, just very briefly about the building, It was designed by an Istanbul architect called Sedat Haki Eldem, who studied with Le Corbusier in Paris in the 20s. And this coffee house was built in the 40s, and it was his self-conscious attempt to marry the European modernism with traditional Ottoman architectural vocabulary, and a very successful one. And of course, and it was a very beautiful site overlooking the Bosphorus. And as a coffee house, of course, anyone could go there. And we were in the still in the Turkey of Atatürk, so we were still in the revisionist, modernist, enlightenment, republican Turkey with separation of church and state, emancipation of women, the whole thing, which Erdogan now is trying to turn back. He wants to be the new sultan. It's horrible what's happening there. I could weep. But at that time, that was the situation. So it seemed to me right away that particular coffee house and the initiative that the architect had taken was the architectural expression of those values. And it was very important, and it was also a beautiful building. And it had been torn down. Why? To make way for this awful zillion-star hotel. And at one time, you could go and enjoy the view for the price of a cup of coffee, and now you had to spend, you know, a few thousand dollars on a room to get a view of the Bosphorus. So there was a lot of that going off. Strictly illegal building projects, but even the mayor of Istanbul couldn't do anything about it because somebody would have a crony in Ankara in the close to the government and he'd be overruled. I mean, the mayor of Istanbul would not go into the Hilton in Istanbul. If there was a meeting there, he'd refuse to go in there. So I thought, okay, the building was important for all kinds of reasons. And what's also important is this process that's going off now of the appropriation of public space for these awful projects, greedy money-making projects. And another example of that, of course, was when Erdogan wanted to build this monstrous thing, money-making thing, in a public park in the middle of Istanbul, and there was that massive protest. So I decided I wanted to do something about that history. Well, I couldn't photograph it, so what do? I thought for a while of commissioning a maquette, the actual physical model that I could move cameras around. But then I opted for the alternative, which was to have it modeled in 3D space, which I didn't know how to do at that time. So I commissioned two young guys, architects, who did that for a living. And then together we researched and we found old photographs and drawings and so on. And then they built the thing. And then I was able, I then learned enough to be able to move cameras and that's how that came about. But then after that, I decided I wanted to learn to do that myself.
Was that the first work in which you were dealing with a building that had disappeared and the relationship of another building to it?
Good question. Off the top of my head, quite possibly. But of course, Prairie is another work.
Yeah. Of that ilk. Yeah, no, absolutely. But that's a later work, right?
Yes, that's later work. Yeah, that could have been the first
one. And what's elective affinities is what date?
Oh, well, actually, you're right. That was an even earlier work from about, I think, 2000. Where in that case, the invitation was to go to Barcelona, and I worked with the Barcelona Pavilion, which is very close, of course, in design to Crown Hall, the Mies van der Rohe building in Chicago. And the Barcelona Pavilion, you could say, oh, well, that's there, it hasn't been pulled down. Well, it was pulled down in 1929, it was built in 1928 as a temporary pavilion for the expo at that time. And then it was pulled down, and then it was rebuilt in the late 80s, like 88, it was rebuilt on the same footprint.
And Solido Posto deals with Mount Stella Park, which is built on the site of a ruin.
Yes.
So there's another,
yes.
It's a running theme in your work, clearly.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And of course, you are layering or sedimenting buildings also in the little house
yeah.
by showing the by showing a different house, one house, while we're looking at another.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So could we maybe talk a little bit about where that puts us, these, where we are when we are hearing about one space and looking at another? Because you've written so much and so brilliantly about space. Mm. Or maybe this.
There's so much to say. I mean, where,
oh, okay.
You know, where does one start? But I mean, so, yeah, certainly, that's what I'm trying to represent, you know, if represent is the right word. You might use other words like evoke or whatever. But yes, I'm trying to represent that fact of, in fact, I said, you know, I think the other day that at one stage, you know, way back when I was at Yale, I was reading Wittgenstein a lot, and I was very interested in something he says, where he speaks of looking at something and thinking about it at the same time. And I've always been intrigued by that idea of looking at something, but in one's head, one's somewhere else. You know, everyday experience, this is not anything abstruse. But I think because it's so familiar that one tends to not notice it, but that's what I try to represent.
It's like the principle of binocular disparity carried, metaphorized in a certain sense, that each eye sees something slightly differently,
yes.
But we have no access to that, but you are now mapping that onto a different set of terms.
Mm. Yeah, it's like we're always in at least two spaces or times at once, whether it's the 18th century and the 1920s or...
Yes,
yeah.
It seems really interesting to probe further, and I look forward to reading what you have to say at some point in time about it. At any rate, I read that wonderful passage yesterday from the Remembered film about the Barcelona, the Mies van der Rohe building in Barcelona, and you're feeling haunted by it, but also almost like it was a Moebius strip, or there was some logic of the unconscious about the structure of that building that was addressing you in a way that did seem more, I don't want to use the word personal, but you were writing in a way that was more recognizably psychoanalytic there.
There's an analogy, perhaps, with the construction of the subject. Mm. You know, the human as human individuals. You know, we're sedimented layers of different people.
Yeah.
You know, if I look back from my present age to what I was at the age of 25, I see a different human being. Mm. At the same time, it's the same. So, you know, again, we all have that experience. We were kids once, and we never lose that. This is something that psychoanalysis deals with.
But this is the interesting thing of you being haunted by a space that you have no biographical connection to. That is so interesting. And then you had this notion of a double haunting. The building was itself haunted by Barcelona. The building was haunted by Barcelona.
I think... rather than say, although it's not incorrect, but to refine it a little, rather than say I'm haunted by a space, it's rather that there are certain spaces that seem to have the capacity to produce ghosts, to reveal ghosts, not to produce them. So ghosts are all there, you know, as you're sitting there now, you can imagine these ghosts are walking through you. Maybe they can see you and you can't see them. Those who were on this ground before we were here, all the way back to whoever the original indigenous peoples were, which of course is one of the themes of Prairie. And there are certain spaces which focus and bring into presence, into consciousness, those ghosts. So in the case of Prairie, being in Crown Hall, and knowing that history of the Mecca, and knowing that Crown Hall is on the footprint, the actual footprint of the Mecca apartment building, and then being aware that just as these clean-cut, well-heeled, IIT, destined for great things. Students in Crown Hall are walking through, brushing shoulders with the ghosts of the inhabitants of the Mecca who were turned out of there so that the building could be demolished. And those inhabitants of the Mecca, in turn, were brushing shoulders with the ghosts of the indigenous people who trod the prairie before they were there. And those, there are certain spaces which lend themselves to that kind of awareness.
To the awareness, but every space is in a
Every space is saturated with ghosts.
I don't know if Leanne is here, but she asked you that question about the status of the ground, and now I'm thinking the discussion we're having now, the ground has another whole meaning, being haunted by those below the ground.
It's kind of palimpsest of history. Yeah.